Good afternoon, you're very welcome to today's edition of Saturday with Clare Byrne. Éireann Glory News, St Patrick's Day exodus, while Brexit triggering looms this week, should ministers change their plans? A government minister says surviving nuns should be interviewed about what happened at the Tuam mother and baby home, regardless of their age. Is he right? And why families in the foster home scandal are still unhappy with the planned commission of investigation. That's all to come after the news now with Clodagh Walsh. Clodagh, thank you very much. This is Saturday with Clare Byrne. You're very welcome to the programme, and we'd like to get you to get in touch over the course of the next hour. The text number 51551, Twitter at Saturday RTE. Joining us on the programme today from our Waterford studio, we have John Halligan, TD for Waterford with the Independent Alliance and Minister for State for Training and Skills. Thomas Byrne, Fianna Fáil TD, is beside me here in Dublin, along with Ruth Coppinger, of the newly named Solidarity Party and TD for Dublin West. Daniel McConnell, political editor with the Irish Examiner, and David Quinn, columnist with the Irish Independent and director of the Iona Institute. John, I'm just going to start with you because you're heading off to Brazil tomorrow, isn't that right?
Correct,
as part of the St Patrick's Day trips. But what we know is that Theresa May might just, it's not certain, but she might just trigger Article 50, which will be the Brexit negotiation process on Wednesday. Do you think that as a government you should be rethinking the St Patrick's Day exodus?
Well, I suppose, first of all, just let me say that Taoiseach did call every minister in some weeks back and made it quite clear that every minister, junior and senior, would be sent out of the country based on what might happen with Brexit to as many countries as possible. I think that the plans have been ongoing politically and officially since last summer regarding Brexit. And like, if the first gathering does go ahead on Brussels on April the 6th, as suggested, I'm not too sure that moving the date forward will make much of a difference at this stage. And by the way, I would say that all ministers are required to be on a day's notice to return back to your country if need be. Most of the senior ministers, by the way, are in Europe. And all of, by the way, I should also say this, and this is not making an excuse for Patrick's Day by any stretch of the imagination. If you look at the itinerary of all ministers, all of the itinerary has been based around trade missions and education, jobs, enterprise and innovation. In Brazil, for instance, I will meet the Brazilian government, Minister for Education, Jobs, Enterprise, Ministers for Research. And remember that, for instance, in education at one stage, the Brazilian students coming to Ireland were contributing a huge amount of money, millions of euro, to the Irish economy. I could just further say this. I came back from India, where every university in Ireland was represented in ITs on student exchange. It brings in 1.3 billion into the Irish economy. So sometimes some of these trips, as against public opinion, are worthwhile.
Okay, what do you think, Diane McConnell?
I've been a long standing supporter of the mass exodus. I do think, having travelled with the Taoiseach on numerous occasions to Washington, I think you see firsthand the value of these trips.
We're not questioning that. It's just the week that's in it, really.
I was just going to come to the point that I think while most eyes will be on the events of Washington in the coming days, I think a very strong eye will be kept on the events in Westminster. And if it does happen that Theresa May triggers it on by the 15th, which is the earliest that she can do it, once it passed through the House of Lords, then I think that would make things very interesting, because I think it's not ideal to have the cabinet and the ranks of junior ministers spread all over the world at that, if that was to happen at that particular time. But again, the normal business can't be put on hold indefinitely, and I think that air of frustration was vented certainly by the Taoiseach in Brussels yesterday, because we've been waiting and waiting and waiting to get any sort of clarity from Theresa May as to her intentions. And also, as well, you know, he asked her directly at a meeting the other night, and she wouldn't tell him anything. So,
Thomas Byrne.
Yeah, well, I'm not going to say that the exodus shouldn't happen. I think it should. I think it's really, really important that a minister's out selling the country. One thing that might solve the problem would have been appointing a cabinet-level minister for Brexit, as Micheál Martin has consistently called for, and now has appointed Stephen Donnelly as our Brexit spokesperson on the front bench. So presumably, if you had a Brexit minister at cabinet level, they wouldn't be going abroad, and that person would be able to coordinate it. So that's just one example of where that minister would come in handy. But I think there are many instances where a minister like that would be absolutely essential in the national interest over the next number of years.
I doubt it's going to happen now, though, because the government has already argued so strongly with the likes of your party that we shouldn't have one, that they're hardly going to backtrack now.
Well, they may, because perhaps the work will become so overwhelming, because let's face it, like, nothing has happened in relation to Brexit up to now. I mean, except the legislation going through the British House of Commons and House of Lords and the referendum, but now it's going to be the negotiations about what actually happens. Every little thing that Europe affects is going to be negotiated. Our border with the North is just one of them, and the amount of issues relating to that, there are issues all over the place. The Taoiseach raised an issue about money that the UK owes, so there's a huge divorce settlement to happen here, and I think that it is going to take up a huge amount of Irish government time, and every government time, but particularly Irish, because of our land border and our huge and very close trading mm-hmm. relationship with the UK.
But look, as John says, the ministers who are away can be back on a day's notice, and they've been told that's what they need to be ready for.
They can, but we saw with one minister, Catherine Zappone, who was, and I have no problem with her being away on a family event, and that's certainly her right, and I admire her, but you know, she wasn't in touch with what was going on at that time, even though she was, in fairness to her, only away for a very, very short period of time. So I think that there are issues there with ministers.
She would probably
abroad.
Say that she was in touch with what was going on,
but
she clearly, just wasn't here.
Clearly she wasn't in a position to be very, very clear as to what was happening at that particular time in relation to the Maurice McCabe issue. I mean, that was clear. There was an inconsistency in statements. So there is a difficulty with ministers, with anyone being abroad and trying to do their job remotely. That does create a difficulty. So if there was a minister for Brexit in place, presumably that minister would either be in Dublin or in London dealing with whatever fallout happens. And there's going to be a demand, for example, for, I presume, Irish politicians to appear in British media, etc., etc., over the next week. It's just going to be one of those things. And that's only a PR job. But in terms of the real work as well, that's going to have to start immediately, because don't forget, there is that.
Look, you can get Stephen Donnelly to do it. It'd be great.
Certainly, if we were in government, there would be
staying at home, so he could do it all.
There would be.
That's true.
Well, he's having too many arguments with his junior minister, so maybe it's just as well he's here. But
John Halligan wants to come back
I think I sort of agree with Thomas, and I can see where he's coming from on it. But I think that there is a constant review. I think one thing that is common with most politicians in the Dáil, that there is this serious effort being put in place to deal with Brexit, in the sense that we're all conscious that there's the unknown factor and we're not too sure that what might happen. So, I mean, like...
What Thomas said do you agree with? The need for a Brexit minister?
Well, I think that I wouldn't disagree with it. I don't see a huge problem with it. I have to be upfront and honest with it. But I do think that particularly all of the senior ministers are more than capable of dealing. We all are, as a matter of fact, because we've all been thoroughly briefed by each department on what may happen or what may not happen with Brexit. But like this, you know, talks are ongoing. Situations can change. It may come to the point where we may have to appoint a Brexit minister, and I'm just making the point that I don't disagree with Thomas on that.
Just on the general point about the mass exodus by ministers out of the country on St. Patrick's Week, I mean, I don't have an issue with ministers going to meet the diaspora in different countries. I would question some of the trips and whether they're essential. I don't think the country will collapse without ministers. In relation to Brexit, I would have thought, though, it's bizarre. If we don't know, it's going to be triggered. I mean, if there isn't that connection between British and Irish officials when we have a land border. And there's something very simple could happen
here. No one knows. I mean, I'm just looking at the ticker on Sky News. There's a screen behind your head, Ruth, saying that EU leaders are being told to prepare for Brexit being triggered possibly as early as Tuesday. So nobody knows. It's not just us who are being kept in the dark.
Yeah, it just seems bizarre that we have a land border and that there wouldn't be that level of communication between British officials and the Irish officials. But can I just say this could be ended very simply. There's been a huge debate about Enda Kenny going to the White House, for example. I don't think he should go. I think he said himself Trump is racist and dangerous, and I think he could have shown solidarity and made it a huge issue by not going. And by
depends on what he says,
Trump,
though, surely, when he gets there.
Yeah, but I don't think anyone believes Enda Kenny's in any position. He's in his demise anyway, but certainly he's not the type to look Donald Trump in the eye and tell him you're racist, you're dangerous. That's not why he's going. He's going to, you know, worship, I suppose, at the altar of American foreign direct investment, and I don't know why he's going. He's not going to be able to get a secret deal for Irish undocumented if that's why he's going. But certainly, I think it would be much more appreciated by minorities, by women, people who are under the cosh from Donald Trump, if the Irish deprived Donald Trump of a PR opportunity this week.
David Quinn, you were going to come in there earlier.
Just in terms of the question asked, I mean, I don't think it's going to make a blind bit of difference. Obviously, Minister's been out of the country for a few days. I mean, and they can't hold any business, because of the uncertainty of when Brexit will be triggered. I mean, as was being said previously, it's a fantastic opportunity, St. Patrick's Day, to get out into the world and obviously, you know, set up these trade meetings and so on. And Ireland is actually kind of lucky in that it has a national day, which is marked in some way, shape or form in so many parts of the world. I even heard from somebody that they're going to try and mark St. Patrick's Day in Damascus this year. I mean, I don't know what that's going to consist of, but nonetheless, it just goes to show you. So I think we kind of underestimate, actually, the extent to which that day is a fantastic marketing, if I can put it that way, opportunity for Ireland, which is marked in so many parts of the world, because I don't think all that many countries have a national day that is marked in so many parts
of the
world.
Do you have a view on the Donald Trump aspect of all of this?
Well, I think that he should go. I think he should state his point of view. I also think when the Irish meet people like the president of China, Xi Jinping, they should say the same thing. I think when they could go to Saudi Arabia on a trade delegation, they should make any points they need to make about human rights issues.
Ruth, what you mentioned the immigrant issue. Do you think that Enda Kenny should use that visit to push the agenda for the undocumented Irish, as some call them, the illegals, as others might say?
I think Enda Kenny should go over and meet Irish people and should meet undocumented Irish and undocumented Latinos and others as well. The way that issue is going to be resolved, though, is not going to be a meeting on St. Patrick's Day. It's going to be Americans or people within America themselves protesting against Trump if he does try to deport people and making his policies unworkable, as they've demonstrated that they did do in relation to the Muslim ban. You know, instinctively, young people in particular protested at airports, came out, sent a message to the administration, gave strength then to judges to challenge Trump. And that's really how this will be sorted out. I mean, the idea that, you know, a meeting between Enda Kenny and Trump will sort that out. It will be a message being sent, particularly by young people who are disgusted at this turn in America of becoming anti-immigrant, anti-minority.
2.5 million were
deported. Could I come back in a second, please?
Obama.
Yes, they were.
And almost nobody got out of an island.
Okay. That is true. Some of those policies were started under Obama. I mean, I'm not a fan of
Obama. And the undocumented/illegal Irish weren't sorted out under him either, so just to kind of put that on the record.
John Halligan, coming back again.
I made my position quite clear with Shane Ross, I believed, and I can understand why the Taoiseach wants to go. I don't think he should have gone. I think we're dealing with an individual he promotes division, hatred. He's actually hostile to the free press. He's a misogynist. He's a liar. He's a sexual predator, as a matter of fact, where he boasted about how he can sexually assault women. Why would we deal with someone like that? Now, I agree.
But John, do you mind me asking then? Sorry to go
you're
across
okay,
it. It's just Shane Ross said he felt the same.
Yes.
I mean, how much influence is the Independent Alliance able to exert in government then?
Well, I mean, we speak our mind, and we did bring it up at Cabinet, but we were the only two of us, we were the only two ministers that opposed him going, and we did make it quite clear for the very reasons that I've given you. One of the reasons we gave was that we already have connections and very strong connections with members of the Republican Party and the Democrats and the various, if you like, businesses associated. I actually met the American Chamber of Commerce last week, who are doing everything they can to consolidate and collaborate with Ireland. So I didn't necessarily think that we needed to meet this guy. I particularly would not meet him and would refuse to meet him, and I agree with you on that. But to answer your question, we did very forcefully bring it. But remember, there was only two members of the Cabinet. I'm not a member of the Cabinet, by the way. There was only two ministers, that's Shane and myself, that vehemently opposed the Taoiseach going to meet him.
Thomas?
Look, I think I don't disagree with a lot of what John has said in relation to Donald Trump as a person, but you're not going over there. The Taoiseach is not going over there to meet Donald Trump, the person. He's going over there to meet the President of the United States, and that's who you have to deal with. And, you know, countries have to deal with other countries, and there is a benefit attached to that. And I would say, actually, I would contradict one thing John said.
But hang on now. It gives tacit approval to Donald Trump to go over and shake his hand.
No, it doesn't. I mean, we meet, as Ruth said, we Saudi Arabia, we meet these countries all the time. I mean, we don't boycott them.
But that gives him tacit approval as well.
I don't think he gives tacit approval. I think it's in the normal run of things that nation states would meet each other. Ireland has had a long relationship with the US. We have a lot of people over there, so I think it's only right that we would meet the leader of that country, whoever that person is. What I'd say is, though, a slight disagreement with John. I don't think our connections with the Republican Party are all that strong. We have some connections, definitely. Sure. But I think our relations with the Democrats, and it's one thing I noticed, I was at the Democratic Convention myself, we have very strong relations with the Democratic Party. But I think it is actually important that this politicians in this country develop strong relations with the Republican Party, who by and large control all of the levers of power in the United States at the moment and have more influence than the Democrats at the moment do.
Okay.
We need to spread our wings, I think, in that regard.
John, who's listening, says the St. Patrick's Day trade mission should go ahead. Brexit will evolve over a long period of time. A few days won't make any difference. And another listener says Enda can tell Trump to keep troops out of Shannon and use UK air bases. We'll take a quick break. We'll be back with more after this. Welcome back. Joining us today from Waterford, we have Minister of State John Halligan from the Independent Alliance, Thomas Byrne, Fianna Fáil TD, Ruth Coppinger, Solidarity TD, Daniel McConnell, political editor with the Irish Examiner, and David Quinn, columnist with the Irish Independent. On Wednesday, Minister of State Finian McGrath was forced to withdraw the terms of reference into a commission of investigation into the case of Grace, the disabled woman who was left in a foster home despite allegations of serious abuse. Mr McGrath was strongly criticised by the opposition and the two whistleblowers at the centre of the case. They all said the scope of the investigation was too narrow. Now, Daniel, you have, and your colleagues have been writing in detail about this in the Examiner. Tell us, first of all, what you know of what happened in the Dáil, so the political story behind the change in the terms of reference.
So the debate kicked off on Tuesday night and Finian McGrath brought in his initial terms of reference, which were a narrowing of what was previously recommended in the Conor Dignam report. This was the original scoping exercise report commissioned by Kathleen Lynch, Finian McGrath's predecessor. The terms of reference in Dignam were very robust, very inclusive, wanted to deal with whistleblowers, wanted to deal with the other cases in the home, the other 46 cases in the home. Finian McGrath's original decision was to just narrow this down to Grace at the start. And a lot of the dealings in relation to the HSC and its handling of whistleblowers, its treatment of documentation and information were excluded from those terms of reference. That obviously led to strong criticism from across the political floor, even from within government, from the likes of John Deasy. On Tuesday night, what happened was that the two whistleblowers were in Leinster House and essentially held a series of meetings with Brendan Howland, who was the first person on Tuesday night to flag that the terms were deficient. He sought legal advice and basically found that, you know, there was only a commitment for a scoping exercise into the other cases in the terms of reference as he read. And that obviously led to an awful lot of criticism. So the whistleblowers met with Brendan Howland.
Just remind us how many children went through that.
47 in total.
Okay. So you would have been leaving off 46.
Yeah. Now, Finian McGrath says there was a commitment to deal with those other cases after the Grace case was dealt with. However, clearly there was not political agreement on that. The whistleblowers held, as I said, a number of meetings, literally on the corridors of Leinster House. I'm not talking about, they weren't in any room, they were literally on, like, I don't know if you know, they're long, narrow corridors and there's kind of couches dotted along the way, and they were literally...
So in plain sight, they're talking and lobbying about what should be included.
One of the meetings that was sought was with Micheál Martin, and John McGuinness, who has been to the fore of this issue, essentially had to drag Micheál Martin to the meeting because he was going from one meeting to another and wasn't in a position, to my information, that he showed an initial reluctance to meet the two whistleblowers. He eventually did meet the two of them. Convinced him that the terms of reference were deficient. It was interesting that Fianna Fáil, at the start of the debate, were in support of the more narrow terms of reference. However, the following morning, when the debate recommenced, Fianna Fáil had a very different view, and Micheál Martin was leading the charge of leaders' questions for those terms of reference to be expanded again to reflect the Conor Dignam. So clearly there was a change of position overnight. But there were two very key interventions on Wednesday morning from John Deasy and John McGuinness. They spoke for 5 minutes each, and John Deasy set out a very detailed case of what he saw was a systematic and comprehensive cover-up within the HSC of files, their treatment of the whistleblowers from not just from 2008 onwards, but before that, because it's not just Grace's case. There's people like Sarah, who we've also heard about in recent days as well, whose treatment was, in some aspects, even more horrific than Grace. And the details
utterly horrific. Yeah.
Her mother, Sarah's mother, you know, was essentially the original whistleblower, but at the time was told to shut up, go away, was refused help and had to go to Northern Ireland to get help for her daughter. And all the way along, so you can imagine their frustration and concern when they found that their case was going to be kind of excluded. But what was very interesting was John McGuinness on Tuesday night text texted Micheál Martin and basically said, listen, our position on this is a disgrace and we need to, it's time to get this right. And as I said, that led to the change of heart. And I think it was that change from Fianna Fáil's position more than anything else that, that led to Finian McGrath's decision to withdraw the terms of reference. And my information is that, you know, there was a realisation within government buildings to do so, and a nod came down from on high to basically say pull it, because Enda didn't want to go into leaders' questions an hour and a half later and this issue still being live. So that's
so you're saying that Enda Kenny gave the instruction for the terms of reference.
That's my understanding.
Because
Simon Harris, the health minister, came into the Dáil chamber and during the debate, and it's clear, my information is that, you know, certainly whereas if Finian was heading that way, he certainly was made, it was made clear, it's time to kill this.
Okay.
You know, let's pull the terms of reference as they are. And even the procedural method of how it actually happened was farcical. You had Brendan Howlin essentially telling both Simon Harris and Finian McGrath as to how to do it procedurally. Because, you know, like, the Dáil has very strict rules as to how motions can be tabled and withdrawn and all that sort of stuff. If anyone watches back on the tape, it's 5 minutes of absolute farce as to what happened. But ultimately, the right thing was done at the end of the day.
OK, well, we'll come to John Halligan on the government side of things in a moment. But the Fianna Fáil issue, Thomas, your children's spokesperson, Margaret Murphy O'Mahony, supported the original narrow terms of reference and then everything flipped. It sounds messy. What happened?
Yeah, well, certainly I just wanted this statement that Danny has just made, that Micheál Martin was reluctant to meet whistleblowers. That's certainly absolutely new to me here. That has not been put to me before, and I certainly have...
I wrote about it the other day.
I can't find in your article what you're saying about that reluctance. I mean, you certainly described other things, and certainly Micheál has met many whistleblowers.
Can we just clarify what you know about that, Daniel? Yeah. Are you saying that he was very busy and he had scheduled meetings, or he did not want to speak to
those
individuals?
There was a request made directly from John McGuinness that they told him that the whistleblowers are in Leinster House, and there was either, I can't go, I'm bouncing in and out of meetings, and the next thing he walked down through the corridors past the whistleblowers, and then all of a sudden they ended up having a chat.
Okay.
Well, I certainly can't respond to that. I wasn't involved in it, but it's certainly not the practice that Micheál Martin has met numerous whistleblowers over the last number of years, and I'm pretty certain as well that Margaret Murphy O'Mahony...
I'm not saying it's bona fides, Thomas. I'm just saying the kind of the well, circumstance on the night.
Yeah. Well, Margaret Murphy O'Mahony, as I understood them, has met them as well. I think the way we approached this was, and I think in fairness, pretty much everybody approached this from a non-political point of view. I mean, you know, this was a job that had to be done in terms of getting a commission investigation underway. I know
but you got it wrong in the first instance.
Well, what we did was we took Finian McGrath to be genuine in doing this, and that there was a commitment there that this would be dealt with.
Hang on, you've your own minds too, though. I mean, you know that 47 people went through that foster home. There was only one case going to be examined in his terms of reference, and you supported that.
Yeah, the original terms of reference did allow for it. Now, it wasn't as explicit as now has been agreed by all parties. I accept that. And, you know, there was a debate in the Dáil, and obviously John McGuinness and John Deasy have been very, very, obviously, are the sources for much of this in terms of what's going on in the Dáil, made strong objections. And there certainly was contact between John McGuinness and Micheál Martin and clearly other parliamentarians in relation to this. So the terms of reference were changed. There's no doubt that happened. And they are clearer and everybody agrees with them. And it's not something we've approached in terms of political battle. It's now agreed, and let's happen. Let this happen.
It
I mean,
is,
the political consequences of the political activities of the last week are of nothing compared with what has gone on, and are of nothing compared with actually getting to the truth of what went on, which is what a commission investigation is what is about. And by the way, it's what a parliament and a parliamentary debate is supposed to be about. I mean, too long we're told governments are rubber stamping everything. Now some parliamentarians came in and made some good points that were accepted by the Dáil, and that's the way the Dáil is meant to work, and it did that. And then subsequent to that, almost immediately the next day
so
or whatever.
So it's new politics,
well,
you say?
I'm not going to belittle this issue by attaching that political term to it. What I'm saying is, it is the way a parliament is supposed to work, and that's what happened this week. And I hope that the Commission of Investigation now can get to the bottom of this and get the answers.
Ruth, do you agree with that?
No, I don't. I think it's utterly bizarre that Finian McGrath thought that one person being investigated, one child out of the 47, would be sufficient. I spoke on this on Tuesday night in the Dáil, and I said exactly that the terms of reference weren't good enough, they had to be expanded. I would say it does seem to be only if such a demand emanates from within Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael it starts to be taken seriously, because other people spoke on Tuesday night in the debate and made these points, you know, Independence for Change, the Social Democrats and others. But just on the broad issue, this is extremely recent. That's why it's so chilling. That first, there's so many questions. How was it that children could be left there for so long. How was his family approved in the first place for foster care when they were actually only signed up for respite? And how could children be left there after a number of social workers had made points about it? There's two other questions that struck me when I was preparing to speak on Tuesday. In 1996, there was an intervention, a communication from the family to the Minister for Health at the time. The family appealed the children being taken away from them. They wrote to the Minister for Health at the time, Michael Noonan. Was there some change arising from an intervention by the minister? That question has to be examined.
And he says not. He says that...
Well, it has to be examined.
I think, Daniel, and your paper published an excerpt of a letter written by the Michael Noonan's private secretary at the time, which said that the health board had reversed its decision.
That's right, and that there was a delay in terms of the initial decision to remove it, that there was a delay to allow a second panel make it a determination. There was 2 3-person panels to determine. One, the first panel to said Grace should be removed from the home. That was reviewed a number of months later and Grace ultimately was left in the home.
Okay. But he now, has said, Michael he Noonan, said categorically to you, hasn't he, that he had nothing
Michael
to
Noonan,
do with
but like, the decision
making.
First rose in the run-up to the general election last year, and I put it to Michael Noonan at a press conference. I said, listen, you know, what happened here, you know, and he also spoke about it to Richard Crowley on the News at One, because I think it was Claire Daly who raised it in the Dáil initially. But we got our hands on the letter and we printed the letter from the foster father to Michael Noonan. And he insists that all he essentially did was he got the representation and passed it down the line. What we have been asking is, well, who exactly did it go down the line to? Was it a case that a minister kind of referred a matter down, and the effect of that was a query's been made from on high and officials took that to be leave things as they are, as often happened in the system at that time. Michael Noonan may not have had any direct input, and there's certainly no evidence as of yet to suggest that there was any sort of direct intervention from Michael Noonan that led to Grace being left in the home. But I think Ruth is right. I think there is unanswered questions here
But the Commission will look at all of that now.
But the other issue is, one thing that was really chilling to me is that Grace eventually ended up in a sexual assault unit in as late as 2009. And was so distressed, she couldn't be properly evaluated and examined. But there was bruising on her breasts and thighs. And she was sent back into the house that night. Now, I thought that we had, you know, reached a point where there was a certain way of dealing with sexual abuse, sexual assault, rape, etc., that would never, ever happen to a vulnerable person. And this is 2009. And can I say, I think the reason for the mess up on this is that the government is so keen, because they're stumbling from crisis to crisis, to get these things boxed off, tick off, or we've a commission of investigation, that they're not actually examining. And of course, let's face it, the lame opposition in inverted commas from Fianna Fáil, it's non-existent. All of this happened under Fianna Fáil's watch. That might be another reason why they don't want too much of a light shined on it. Because there's systemic issues here for the HSE. These aren't just mistakes. These are systemic issues.
I'm just appalled that any kind of politics is being brought into this. There are questions to be answered by whether it's politicians or social workers, HSE administrators in relation to this. They have to be answered. We want to get to the truth. Can I just say this very, very clearly? We dealt genuinely with Fianna McGrath, whose approach was from the start that the Grace issue would be dealt with first, and that there would be information obviously gleaned from that of a general nature as well about the home that might be of use to further investigations. That was the approach. We dealt with that on a bona fide basis. That wasn't then accepted by some individuals. There was a parliamentary debate. The terms of reference were changed. Within a couple of days, they're all agreed. Now, just in relation to Micheál, I've just made contact with some people who know. Micheál received a text at 6:10 and was simply unable to have a meeting. He's continually met whistleblowers and is always available to meet them. And I think that is thrown in as somehow relevant to getting to the truth of the answer, getting to the truth of the issue here and getting answers to the question and getting the Commission investigation up and running is irrelevant. The Commission investigation is now agreed by all parties in the Dáil.
So brush over the last week and the fact that
I'm not brushing over the last week.
David Quinn, and then I want to hear from John Hannigan. I'll come to you, John, in a second. David
Quinn. That's a brief point. I mean, HICWA, the health inspector, releases reports on a regular basis that, among other things, looks at foster care in various areas and frequently finds, for example, that foster homes are not properly inspected, that there's big gaps in terms of their knowledge of how the children in these foster homes are getting on. So you wonder what else is going on. Maybe not on the scale of Grace, but nonetheless failings. And so perhaps the inquiry needs to broaden itself out and have a proper look actually at what's going on elsewhere as well in the whole foster care system.
Okay, John Halligan, did you speak to Finian McGrath at all about the terms of reference here? Were you concerned when he was presenting them that they just didn't go far enough and that all of this trouble would happen?
Okay. Well, first of all, Finian reported to the Independent Alliance meeting. We meet every Tuesday. And I'm just coming back to what Ruth said. Finian McGrath did not think, nor never thought, that this was just going to be about Grace or the Grace case, as it has been described. His overwhelming priority at the time, and if you can recall, all of this was about Grace, and there wasn't an awful lot of mention about the other 46, although there should have been, was that Grace and her family got through, and that they got, if you like, decisive action, and that they got it without delay. When he, at the Independent Alliance meeting, on no occasion did he say that this was it. He actually said quite categorically that the other 46 children had to, the truth had to be got there as well. He genuinely felt that if we could get the Grace case started and over the line, or partly over the line, that there was never, ever, ever, and I don't think that's the case with any member in Cabinet, which I'm never privy to what goes on in Cabinet meetings, just the basic stuff. But I do know this, that both Shane Ross and himself insisted time and time again that there was 47 children going to be dealt with. Now, as it transpired, the terms of reference probably were too narrow. But I do think that...
Like, did nobody say, how will the families of the other 46 children
if
feel
I,
about
yes,
this?
Yes, if I could come to that, first of all, and Thomas is right, I do believe that Micheál Martin met the whistleblowers. I know that to be true. I also know that Finian McGrath met the whistleblowers on two occasions. On two occasions. And I think I'm referring back to what Thomas said, that this was stressful for everybody, and particularly stressful for Finian McGrath. And I've seen him, and I know him to be an honest and a decent guy who works very, very hard for disability services, and he was completely stressed out that week. And I think that this is where democracy and this is where the Dáil came to prominence, where we were able to listen, or he was able to listen to the views of other politicians, like politicians in Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael, Root and others. But also, it was never, ever in his mind, that the 46 children would not be dealt with.
In so his intentions were good, but he got it wrong. Is that what
no,
you're saying?
No, I'm not saying he got it wrong. I really believe that...
But he did, because he changed the terms of reference.
No, I think he was overwhelmed with the priority that Grace and her family got the truth, because this is what he had been taught. I mean, if you can, you have to remember, this has been on his mind for the last couple of months. Every Independent Alliance meeting we had, he would come in and report, and this is what was happening, how we need to get this dealt with. So I think in the heat of this, in the heat of this battle, and the complexity of everything, it is possible that people may feel that he was forgetting about the other 46 children, but he was not. And just before I finish, I just wanted to make a point that Ruth, that's been forgotten, and Ruth is correct on this, that this particular family, and we're talking about the HSE, and I'll be very brief on this, there was never any evidence that this family were approved for full-time carers. There was never any evidence that they were given approval for more than two children at a time. And if you go back to Dr. Cal Morgan, he was, I think, head of the HSE Disability Services at the time, he actually said then that there were significant failings of the health board at the time. And Ruth is correct again. Grace presented herself at what they called the day services. She had severe bruising, she had a black eye, and nobody in the HSE would put two and two together to see what the hell is going on here. So how could we have a setup where the foster home themselves were not approved to be full-time carers, or were not approved to take more than two children? I think it's a goddamn disgrace.
Okay, I think the people in the daycare centre did raise concerns, but they weren't ultimately acted on. Thomas, sorry, you want to come in briefly?
Very briefly, the scandal here is what happened in the home, and there are people at all levels in the bureaucracy as well, in terms of the running of it and the supervision of it, is a scandal. There's no scandal in a minister coming to the Dáil and having a debate with opposition TDs who suggest improvements to terms of reference. That is not a scandal, and the terms of reference are improved. That is actually making things work better.
Daniel, not a scandal?
I would think, ultimately, I don't question Finian McGrath's bona fides on this. I've worked with him a lot on this over the last number of months, and his intentions are true on this. Now, I do think that, you know, somewhere along the lines, the establishment sought to close in on itself and narrow the scope of this inquiry. like if not, then the Dignam recommendations would have been allowed to go through in the terms of reference. There's an embarrassment, heaped upon embarrassment here for the HSE and the health service because of the catastrophic failures all the way along. Not only just in terms of the supervision of the home, but look at the treatment of whistleblowers. Look at their refusal to give information time and time again. Their refusal to be accountable. Let's remember, there are still a number of people, maybe as many as a dozen, who were involved with Grace's care, who are still in the health service as of now,
exactly.
And have never been sanctioned, never been disciplined, never been sacked. Now, I would think that is a disgrace in my view, on a personal level. I think that's a disgrace because there has to be accountability in relation to this. Given this, like, this is not just a kind of a, we can all wring our hands for, you know, this week and next week and move on. Like, these were the most vulnerable people in our society, non-verbal people who were just treated disgracefully. And I just think, you know, on a human level, I'm a father of two young kids myself, and I would dare not to ever think this would ever happen to my kids. But you would, you know, I would think that, you know, it's not good enough just for a report to happen and it be put up on a shelf. You need to, that we need to see accountability at the end of
it. That won't happen. I mean, the Commission will now be able to go into any file they want in relation to this and any information and get sworn evidence from people. So they have huge powers now to get to the bottom of this.
All right, we're just going to take a very quick break and then we'll talk about what has happened over the course of the last 7 days in relation to the Tuam Mother and Baby Home. The Minister for Children and Youth Affairs, Catherine Zappone, has said her department will spend a number of weeks considering how best to broaden the terms of reference of the Commission of Investigation into the Tuam Mother and Baby Home to include other institutions where unmarried women and children lived. Now, Joel Hannigan, I want to come to you here because you have said, rather controversially, that the Gardaí should question the surviving bond secure nuns who worked in that Tuam Mother and Baby Home. Explain why.
Well, first of all, I don't think it's controversial. I have made a point that old age should not diminish accountability for any crime or alleged crime. And I think that if you just have a think about this for a minute, if you bear in mind that the child mortality rate, for instance, at Bessborough in 1943 was approaching 70%, should that similar to concentration camps? So are we seriously saying that because somebody is ill or aged that we shouldn't at least interview him? If you look at what's happened with Belsen, Auschwitz, Dhaka, even up to last year, individuals who were alleged to have carried out horrendous crimes in their 80s and their 90s were interviewed. And I think that a criminal investigation, if I could just say this,
needs, we need to be careful, John, that we don't,
no,
you know,
alleged,
that we don't impugn the people who are still living, who worked there, who may have had nothing to do with any ill treatment of any women or children.
Absolutely, I agree 100%, but we will not know if we do not interview everyone that we can possibly interview. Where are we going to bring an end to this? I made a point, I was addressing a conference at Dublin yesterday, primarily made up of women who, actually some of them said that they weren't, like, they weren't shocked anymore. People have lost their sense of outrage with the horrors that have been committed in this country by the church. And it appears to me that we need to be, I don't even like to use the word proactive anymore. What has happened here is horrendous. We're talking about children that may have been malnourished. By the way, if you bring your child to a hospital and he's malnourished through unless it's a particular diagnosed illness, that's a crime. Are we actually saying that we should not interview people that worked in the home?
I think we need to do that. Let's find out what the rest of our panel think about that. Thomas Byrne, you want to come in there?
Yeah, I mean, look, I certainly have no difficulty with An Garda Síochána getting involved. I probably would welcome it. I think it's best left to them rather than politicians to be directing them to do it. But I would say this, my colleague at the time, Colm Keaveney, was thrown out of the Dáil nearly 3 years ago for trying to raise this issue. Catherine Corliss brought this to her local TDs, including Colm Keaveney at the time, and went to the Daily Mail. That's nearly 3 years ago. And a lot of people are reacting to this news this week because obviously the Commission investigation has formally found the actual true factual extent of it, as if it's new news. It's not. And 3 years on, justice delayed is justice denied. So we're still talking about it and there's still a lot of debate about this. But, you know, what the Commission investigation has been happening. Some people, I'd say, have died. Other people have become even more aged and infirm that may well have information to give. And I think it's going very, very slowly. And I think it's very frustrating. But, you know, let's not forget that while all the shock is there this week, a TD was thrown out of the Dáil column Keaveney in June 2014 about this, David, because he wasn't allowed to discuss it.
David Quinn, what do you say to what John Halligan has just said about the Gardaí interviewing the surviving nuns in the Bon Secure?
Well, I mean, if the guards think, excuse me, that there are reasons to question any surviving nuns, then that's the judgment of the guards. So if, you know, there are reasonable grounds for suspecting criminal activity, then yes, and if not, then no, because obviously the presumption of innocence has to hold as well. But, I mean, one point of frustration of the whole thing is that the Bon Secours sisters have said so little. A few years ago in the Dáil, the then junior Justice Minister, Kathleen Lynch, was talking about the mother and child Bethany home, and she was saying that we need to hear from the people who ran the Bethany home. So I would love to hear more from the Bon Secours sisters. And I think their silence is not helping matters, to put it mildly. Maybe they're waiting until they address the commission. But basically, we're operating in a kind of vacuum to a certain extent.
Tell us what type of issues they should be addressing, or what we need to hear, could clarify.
Why so many died? I mean, the list of the dead is available, and the list of how they died is available, and there was frightening infant mortality rates up until the development of penicillin and vaccinations roughly in the late 40s and early 50s. Did they get in touch with the local county council for more resources? I seem to remember from 2014 reading that there were debates within Galway County Council as to how much resources to devote to the two mother and baby home. But this is the kind of thing, you know, that we need to find out. It's possible, by the way, that the surviving nuns, if there are any, are probably in their 80s, and there actually may be no historical memory of this at all within the order, which to me would be terrible, because I really, really want to see what exactly happened in this home, what exactly happened in all the mother and baby homes, a proper social history of the time, the county homes, everything. I really want to see a commission of inquiry to get to
the bottom. Are you suggesting in what you say that the state may not have invested enough in order to keep the children in the state that they should have been, in other words, healthy and fed?
Well, that's definitely a part of it. I mean, there's kind of two issues. One is the kind of issue of why people ended up, children and their mothers ended up in these homes in the first place. So that's kind of a social history question. And the second question is, once they were in there, they should have been properly looked after. Now, for example, a baby gets measles. And if you look through the death record, you discover that after one gets measles, they're at such close quarters. Within 2 weeks, 12 of them have measles and they're all dead. Whooping cough. There was one period.
The argument that you make about the social conditions at the time works to a certain extent until you hear the story of a woman called Bridget on Liveline during the week, who said she went to confession in London and said to the priest, "I'm pregnant, I don't know what to do." Mm-hmm. Put her in touch with the Catholic League. The Catholic League put her on a boat, sent her back to Ireland, and she was put in best.
Oh, no, I'm not. Sorry. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, the 20th century is the century in which the actions of the Catholic Church basically demolished the Catholic Church. So I'm not making any attempt to excuse the social attitudes of the time. I'm just saying there's two questions. That's one. The second question is the extent to which the homes were resourced. Because again, I was saying, if one child gets measles in close quarters, it then runs through a place like wildfire. No ability to quarantine, it seems. So there is a resources issue. And we're just talking here in the previous section about resources also. The number of child protection failures today as well. So there's resources questions going all the way back to the past, all the way to the present.
Well, just to say, if David wants to know why women were put there, it's a very simple answer. The Catholic Church fed an absolute climate of the time that a woman could not have a child out of wedlock. That's why they were there, and that's why they were in a group. And so if disease spread, they shouldn't be in a home in
Nobody
the first place.
That.
But the other reason is, if you take a baby away from its mother, obviously, well, that's a problem in the first place, because, you know, what about breastfeeding or bottle feeding, but also the emotional support as well. I think what's happened in Tuam is actually a game changer in this country, because we've had lots of scandals regarding the Catholic Church. But the response to this that I'm getting from people is incredible. And it's because it's from an official government commission now, not just Catherine Corliss, who did sterling work. The questions are, of course, there should be a criminal investigation. So I know a woman who was in one of these so-called homes in 1981. It's not that long ago, you know. It's not in the dim and distant past. But all homes should be investigated. All sites should be excavated if possible. And also the whole issue of redress has come back up. I spoke in the Dáil about a week ago on the absolutely penny-pinching attitude of the government's redress scheme for, you know, victims of abuse within institutions. We know the Catholic Church got off unbelievably scot-free in 2002 in terms of having only to commit 100 million. It hasn't even committed that, and it hasn't given over the sites that it did. But I'll tell you why this is a game changer, because the church now has no longer any moral authority to preach about what women should do when they're pregnant, about what young people should do with their lives. And it fed into the huge marches that took place on International Women's Day in Dublin and at 50 locations around the country and abroad. It fed into the whole demand for repeal of the Eighth, where we saw two major mobilisations within the capital on one day, on one issue. We've never seen it before. And what the kind of people that were on that were overwhelmingly young. Like even the march at night, there was a lot of school students.
So you believe there's a connection
I won't tell you what some of the placards said in relation to the church. A lot of them referenced Tuam. And I think
just
that
John Hannigan's kind of coming. I know you can't hear him there, but just pop on your headphones.
Just very briefly, people may not be aware of this. I'm not too sure if you are, but this is extraordinary. In 1946, mind you, the county board's health inspection report recorded how children were emaciated and fragile. Now, that's strong words in 1946. How they said that many more died from disability at birth. Now, there's no question, and I'm coming back to what David said, and he's correct, that in many cases we're down to the mothers not receiving, if you like, proper medical care during childbirth. But remember, the bond security orders were paid a weekly rate to take care of these women and their children.
But perhaps not enough.
Well, we don't know that, and this is why. Well, hold up a minute. Even if they weren't paid enough, would nobody take notice of a child starving to death are suffering from malnutrition and go to someone and say, we have children here that are starving to death. Where are we coming from on this? And this is why I think that there has to be an investigation. Everybody has to be interviewed. And if it is found that they're guilty of neglect, well, their assets should be seized by the Criminal Asset Bureau.
They were also getting money from selling the babies in the US as well. There was a huge trade in that. And
absolutely,
where has that money gone to?
Yes.
Now, we know as well the Bond Secure Order run the most profitable private hospitals in this country right now. So that also has to be factored in relation to redress for the victims.
Absolutely.
Thomas Byrne?
Yeah, I've no difficulty with a lot of that, except that just in general, I think criminal investigations are best left to the Gardaí. I think, as John said, this was raised in the Dáil in the 30s. I've seen it on the record. Noel Lamass TD in the early 70s asked for an inquiry into mother and baby homes. So there was certainly a huge culpability of the Catholic Church and the religious orders, and the state then stood idly by and allowed it to happen. You know?
So do you think there's joint responsibility here? Because
I'm not trying to pass the buck, but certainly in terms of the residential institutions, which were subject of a compensation scheme, the state accepted 50% of the liability because people were forced to go there through a court system in many cases. And now this is a bit different because, as people have said, sometimes the local priest sent you or your family sent you, mm-hmm, or whatever. It wasn't necessarily always the state sending people to mother and baby homes. I don't know the ins and outs, but I was shocked to discover the one in Dunboyne, for example, was open until the early 90s. I think 1991 it closed eventually. So this is very much part of my own lifetime, and I'm really, I have to say, absolutely gobsmacked to be really finding out about it, that this is how it went on. And
okay,
work colleagues and my wife who were in them, and you know, it's incredible.
Well, we have to leave it there, unfortunately. We're out of time, but thank you all very much indeed for joining us today on the programme. I will see you on Monday night, 10:35 for Clare Byrne Live. Hope you can join me then. Callan's Kicks is up next. Have a great weekend.
Saturday with Clare Byrne was produced by Kay Sheehy. The broadcast coordinator was David Phelan. The researcher, Annette Egan, and sound supervision was by Andrew Kane.